This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm Fran Kelly, and I'm delighted to introduce this year's Boyer Lectures. The ABC flagship series of talks began back in 1959, and every year a prominent Australian is invited to share their concerns of the challenges ahead. In 1968, the Boyer lecturer was the eminent anthropologist William Stanner. He alerted us to the position of Indigenous people in Australian society. He called it the Great Australian Silence. 51 years later, as the 2019 Boyer lecturer, Rachel Perkins urges us to listen to the Indigenous voice and end that silence. Rachel Perkins is an award-winning filmmaker and director. Her recent credits include the ABC's Mystery Road and Total Control, which is screening now on ABC TV and on iView. Over her three lectures, we'll hear more about the Uluru Statement, what it means, why it matters, and how this roadmap might be achieved. Here's Rachel Perkins with the first of the 2019 Boyer Lectures.
At the foot of Uluru, the symbolic and spiritual heart of our nation, around 300 people stood together in May 2017 for the First Nations National Constitutional Convention. And I was with them. We were drawn from some 150 Australian tribes whose ancestry runs deep into this country. It was a moment of common purpose about our hopes for the future, embodied in a message sent to the Australian people and known as the Uluru Statement from the Heart. In a few months from now, another group of Australians will stand together, this time on the east coast of Australia, looking out across the shore of Kamay, Botany Bay. This too is a significant site for our nation, and these Australians also have roots in this country, though more recent. And they will stand together to mark the 250th anniversary of the day that the Endeavour dropped anchor and James Cook led a party of men from the British Empire ashore.
Ship company!
Uluru and Kamay Botany Bay, two sites of significance, two gatherings of historical importance, a confluence of our ancient history and our recent past, which will, perhaps, inform our country's future. I am reminded of the distinguished poet and stateswoman, Ujuru Nunukul, when she wrote, "Let no one say the past is dead. The past is all about us and within." For Indigenous people have not lost from our minds the history of our nation, not only its deep past of thousands of years, but also the events on that day, April 29th, 250 years ago, when Cook ordered his men to fire upon the two men standing on the shore. It is likely these men were Gweagal warriors who stood before him in defence of their family who were behind them on the beach. Cook's action signalled the Crown's intentions, the transfer of a continent from one people to another by force if necessary, a phenomenon we politely call colonisation. Of course, our generation weren't standing on the deck of the Endeavour or on the shores of Kamay Botany Bay in 1770, just as we weren't present during the massacres as the colonial frontier progressed from south to north. However, as my father Charles Perkins, the Indigenous leader who came to prominence in the 1960s for the Freedom Ride, always said, we cannot live in the past, but the past lives in us. And the past has made us. We are its inheritors, for better or worse, and this is now our time. How we move forward from this moment will set the course of relationships between Indigenous people and their fellow Australians into the future. And this is what I'd like to talk about with you. While some may see only the opposition between the people at Uluru and those at Kamay Botany Bay, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, asks us to make more effort, to be more perceptive of one another. In his recent PM Glynn lecture, He addressed what he called the challenge of the debates over the public acknowledgement of Indigenous history and presence here in Australia. He's concerned about the threat of political tribalism and says, "Political tribalism is above all a shrinkage of the scope of mutual recognition. I resolve not to think of the other's view as sharing any of the moral anxieties or emotional tensions I experience." He goes on to say,
"Now, let me be clear. I'm not making any sort of bland appeal for civility in political debate. It is rather an appeal for some kind of work here. The work to grasp the history and structure of the way the stranger, the other, is invested in their view."
I was brought up surrounded by politics, trailing after my father from meeting to meeting. My primary role was to make endless cups of tea. So growing up, I saw the hard work required to achieve understanding and consensus. And I also witnessed the extraordinary change it can bring. The Uluru Statement and the Cook Anniversary provide a moment in time, a catalyst to see each other better, to strive for a more holistic national identity. Noel Pearson, lawyer and public intellectual, hopes this might, and I quote, "reveal our true nature and the great hidden architecture of our Commonwealth." He believes our nation consists of three parts, he says.
"There is our ancient heritage, written in the continent, and the original culture painted on its land and seascapes. There is its British inheritance, the structures of government and society transported from the United Kingdom, fixing its foundations in the ancient soil. There is its multicultural achievement, a triumph of immigration that brought together the gifts of peoples and cultures from all over the globe, forming one indissoluble Commonwealth. We stand on the cusp of bringing these three parts of our national story together."
In some way, my heritage reflects this national story. I am Arunda and Kalkadoon from the Desert Peoples. But I am also a descendant of immigrants, a poor Irish miner, and German farmers. This hybrid heritage makes me feel uniquely Australian, and I hope it enables me to identify with these three parts of our nation and to see it from multiple perspectives. I'm no expert. I'm not an elder, politician or lawyer, but I am an Australian. And the aspirations articulated in the Uluru Statement about our shared country are for us, the Australian people, to consider. And that's why the statement is addressed to us, not the government of the day. The statement is the result of more than a decade's consideration and discussion around what has loosely been called Indigenous recognition. That means how the nation acknowledges its Indigenous history and resolves the outstanding legacy of colonisation within our contemporary society. Over the last decade, this challenge has been considered by two parliamentary committees and two independent expert panels who have reported to no less than five prime ministers. Throughout this process, many thousands of Indigenous people have met from across the country to discuss what recognition might mean to them and what might be tenable for the broader Australian community. However, these discussions are far from new. These issues have actually been talked about for more than four decades. But what is significant is that across this time, the Indigenous aspirations have been largely consistent. An earlier version of the process I just described occurred in 1995. My father chaired 34 meetings with Indigenous people across 17 regions to discuss what was referred to then as the Social Justice Package. The package was intended to deal with issues that the Mabo Native Title legislation could not address, and it was commissioned by the government, and I quote, "in acknowledgement of the continuing disadvantage and dispossession of Indigenous people." Back then, the approaching anniversary was the centenary of Federation in 2001, which provided a 5-year deadline to conclude the negotiations over the social justice package. My father and his committee members lodged their report, and his words in the introduction strike me as being as relevant now as they were 20 years ago. He said, "This report is about recognition, rights and reform. Our focus is on institutional, structural, collaborative, cooperative reform. This is not an invitation to sweep it under the carpet. It is a request to ensure it is properly considered and responded to in a timely and responsible manner." The report was swept under the carpet with a change of government, and it was shelved. Almost 20 years later, Megan Davis, an Indigenous professor of constitutional law, was on her first round of consultations as part of the new expert panel on constitutional recognition. Of the experience, she wrote, "Every Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander community around Australia asked what had happened to the social justice package. It is important because it gives you an insight into what Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples thought was an appropriate settlement with respect to dispossession, as recognised by the High Court." The year 2001 came and went with no change. The other anniversary that can't be overlooked, of course, was the bicentennial, marking the 200th year of British occupation, celebrated on the 26th of January 1988, commemorating the day Arthur Phillip rowed ashore at Warang, now known as Circular Quay. With this important date approaching, Indigenous people from the Northern Territory had prepared what they called the Barunga Statement. It was a message to the Prime Minister, Bob Hawke, and it was bordered with an expression of Aboriginal law through the painted images from the Dreaming, or the Algera in my language. Inside this border was the text of the statement. It sought a national Indigenous representative body, a voice. National land rights legislation, remembering this was before the Mabo decision, and a treaty to be negotiated between the federal government and Indigenous Australians. The Prime Minister had agreed to these things, and hopes were high for a treaty process to begin. So there we were on the 26th of January 1988 with great expectations. As the party to celebrate the anniversary of Governor Phillip's arrival was underway down at Circular Quay, we walked en masse in procession through the streets of Sydney to make the Indigenous presence felt. Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people had travelled from across the nation to be in Sydney, and I was there alongside my countrymen and women, their bodies glistening with red ochre. They had made the 3,000-kilometre journey from the Red Centre to hear the promises delivered. Their boomerangs clattering, the sound ricocheted off the sandstone underpass as we walked under the train lines at Central Station. And our fellow Australians were also beside us, in numbers that hadn't been seen since the Vietnam War protests of the 1960s. It was an incredible moment, but its resolution was the anticlimax of the century. The promise had disappeared, as Mundawar Yunupingu and Paul Kelly described in their hit song Treaty, like writing on the sand. Instead, we were given something else, something we did not ask for. I remember after the crowds had left and the Sydney streets were littered with these pamphlets the government had given us, and I held one in my hand and wondered what it meant. The smiling face of the Minister of Aboriginal Affairs featured on the pamphlet, and I remember the printed words. They said something like, "Aboriginal leaders have been talking about reconciliation for many years." The pamphlet announced the government was embarking on a new process called reconciliation, not a treaty. Growing up around Aboriginal politics all my life, I had never heard this word as a key priority, but there it was, reconciliation, a new policy that we were to march toward for the next 10 years. And then, when that destination was not arrived at, it was announced that it would take another 10. Indeed, it is a process that seems to have no end. Professor Megan Davis describes the mismatch between what reconciliation meant to the government and what it meant to Indigenous people at the time. To Indigenous people, reconciliation involved, and she says, the ventilating of stories or a truth and justice process, such as that which is common in many jurisdictions around the world. And here she's referring to places like South Africa. But what we had in fact been given, and the view of many, she writes, was a kind of political confection as a compromise for reneging on the promises made to the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples. I take you back into this past, not to dwell on disappointment or be cynical about anniversaries and opportunities missed, but to demonstrate how Indigenous aspirations have been consistent, and that despite all this disappointment, there is a determination to remain hopeful. And this is the fuel that fires the Uluru Statement from the heart. Hope. Fast forward to 2017. We are seated in the enormous auditorium at Uluru. I have brought in my luggage a massive 10-metre-wide Aboriginal flag that my sister-in-law, Natasha, a non-Indigenous woman, had sewn for my father's funeral 10 years prior. It now hangs from the ceiling to the floor of the auditorium, alongside a similar-scale Torres Strait Islander flag. 300 delegates flanked by these enormous flags wait. And I think of my dad, how he didn't live to see his country come to the resolution he had worked so hard for. And I remember his words, "We cannot live in the past, but the past lives in us." Finally, after many days of heated discussion and much humour, which always accompanies Indigenous meetings, Professor Megan Davis takes the floor to read the Uluru Statement and get the endorsement of all the delegates. In the recording taken at this moment, you can sense the anticipation and tension. 300 blackfellas have never been so quiet. She begins.
"We gathered here at the 2017 National Constitutional Convention, coming from all points of the southern sky, make this statement from the heart. Our Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander tribes were the first sovereign nations of the Australian continent and its adjacent islands, and possessed it under our own laws and customs. This our ancestors did, according to the reckoning of our culture from the creation, according to the common law from time immemorial, and according to science more than 60,000 years ago. This sovereignty is a spiritual notion, the ancestral tie between the land or Mother Nature and the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples who were born therefrom, remain attached thereto, and must one day return thither to be united with our ancestors."
We will hear more from the statement in this lecture series to come. But for now, you should know that at its conclusion, the room rose together in a spontaneous standing ovation. It is true that 7 delegates walked out, good people all of them, but unwilling to support the consensus. Well, this is democracy at work, after all, and those who remain hope to walk together rather than walk away and reach for the understanding that Rowan Williams speaks of. Later that day, in a nod to the Burunga Statement 3 decades earlier, a blank artist's canvas is rolled out. Across its cream, unmarked surface, Noel Pearson inscribes his signature in the right bottom-hand corner. Under this, he also writes the language of his people, Guguyimajir. His Christian name identifies him as an individual in the world, but his language, his tribe, his people, demonstrates the roots of his ancient identity. And this identity has endured against great odds since that day in April, 250 years ago, and it remains so to this day. It had been more than a decade since Noel had crunched along the driveway to the lodge to meet with the then Prime Minister John Howard. He wanted to find a rightful place, as he described it, for this enduring Indigenous identity within our nation. But whereas at the lodge he spoke of a personal position, at Uluru he signed his commitment to a unified Indigenous position. There was no going back. It was a watershed moment for him, both on a personal level and for his country. Pat Anderson was the co-chair of the Referendum Council, and she was charged with directing the process that led to the Uluru Statement. Pat is a battle-scarred but unwavering leader of Indigenous people with 50 years' experience at the coalface of improving Indigenous lives. She also signs the statement alongside Professor Megan Davis, Uluru co-convener and Referendum Council member. Each adds their people's name underneath, Pat Alyawarra and Megan Kobble Kobble. These women have been at the forefront of the often complex and very demanding process of reaching Indigenous consensus. Behind them, the line of delegates waiting to sign the canvas goes out the room and down the corridor as they queue to place their signatures. I proudly add my name too, followed by my languages, the Aranda and Kalkadoon. And I also sign for my friend, who had left that morning. She does not know her language or tribe, because she had been given away at birth for the colour of her skin and is still finding her way back home. And these are the very personal, private complexities of many of our people who live with the often traumatic legacy of the colonisation process. Later, the senior women and custodians from Uluru paint the dreamings of their country as a border around the signatures, reminding us of the importance of the Barunga Statement. And as they paint, they sing the dreamings passed down to them from the Algera. Finally, the words of the Uluru Statement from the Heart, crafted during the 3-day convention, but distilled from more than a dozen previous meetings around the country, are printed in the centre of the canvas. Wrapped in the dreamings of Uluru and grounded by the people from more than 150 Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples, to the beholder, the visual representation of the Uluru Statement reflects what it describes. Ancient Australia speaking to the people of this land, now and into the future. 51 years ago, the esteemed Australian anthropologist William Stanner gave his Boyer lectures on the position of Indigenous people in Australian society. I read his lectures in preparation for mine. So much has been achieved since 1968. Segregation laws have been abolished. Our young people enter tertiary education in unprecedented numbers. Much land has been returned, and our culture is experiencing a wonderful resurgence. But some things remain the same. Stanner called his lecture The Great Australian Silence, which referred to not only our writing of history, but more broadly to a social practice inherent in our country.
It is a structural matter. A view from a window which has been carefully placed to exclude a whole quadrant of the landscape. What may well have begun as a simple forgetting of other possible views turned under habit and over time into something like a cult of forgetfulness practiced on a national scale. We have been able for so long to disremember the Aborigines that we're now hard put to keep them in mind even when we most want to do so.
51 years later, the Uluru Statement from the Heart gives us the roadmap to finally end the Great Australian Silence, this cult of forgetfulness on a national scale, by a constitutional guarantee that Indigenous people's voices will be heard, for the full history of our nation to be finally told and listened to, and for agreements to settle the unfinished business of our nation that began on the shore of Kamei, Botany Bay, 250 years ago. In the next two lectures, we will explore the detail of the statement, and I ask you to join me, for if there is something that we at Uluru share with our fellow Australians, it is our love for our country, our land and our sea that binds us together and makes our futures inseparable. In another 50 years' time, like Stanner, I won't be alive to see what we have accomplished. But I have great hope for the future.
You've been listening to The End of Silence, the first of the three Boyer lectures presented by Indigenous filmmaker and director Rachel Perkins. I'm Fran Kelly. Hope you can join me again at this time next week, or of course download it anytime on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.